Ici Planète Tchatcho. Ah. Neti neti te.
Episode four.
We are back. The boys are back.
Yes.
I am your co-host, Mr. Ivan Idro.
Yes, Ibrahim Obagi here.
Young millionaire. And we're coming back to you guys with episode four. Back in the mix. We're staying consistent this season, so we should get some hand claps.
Serious guys.
Being serious. And production is a lot better.
Yo, we came up with the sound effects.
Perfect.
After I hope you guys enjoyed that one last episode.
I had the shout outs, you know. We've been promising sound effects whole of season one, so we're finally
my
got back to it.
My favorite one was that the dollar sign with the you have to pay for this episode.
Yeah. Ching.
But big up to Nairam for him
Thank
pulling
you.
Up
Thank
last
you to
episode. All the feedback has been great as well.
Yes.
And we're just happy to get going with episode four.
I can't wait. Like, I've been waiting for this all these weeks for this episode.
It's been a long time in the making, but I think this episode was a must.
Yes.
Given that the opportunity presented itself.
I feel like it's the whole basis of why we even started this conversation of where's our heritage, where are we from, why don't we even understand, like, our own family's history to a competent level.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, now we have like a primary source.
There you go. You know,
without further ado,
yes,
we want to put our hands together for my dad, Mr. Patrick Idro.
Hey.
Thank you, guys.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is good. This is a good thing. It's a good program to share and exchange views and see what the world is all about and where it leads, you know?
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday to
yes,
come.
Yes, and happy Mother's Day.
To moms.
Yes, to all our moms, Mamabaji. Aunties, and friends, moms, sisters.
All aunts, to anyone who takes care of, you know, people in a motherly sense, happy Mother's Day to you.
Right, yes.
But yeah, welcome, Pops.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, we need to start with the rundown.
The standard. Who are you?
Okay, that's an interesting question because it really drags back to many, many, many generations.
Mm-hmm.
But let me cut it short to about where my great-grandfather, yeah. That would be a kind of a logical line to start from because there's some history about that. So my name is Patrick Idro, and I come from Uganda, basically the West Nile of Uganda, just borders the Congo and borders Sudan. That's the boundary today, and that's the boundary that we have been living with for all this time. But before that, it used to be called the Equatorial Province. And the Equatorial Province kind of was from Juba in Sudan up there, actually farther than Juba, right down to Lake Turkana in Kenya and up to Soroti in Uganda. So that was what was the Equatorial Province. And my great-grandfather, Kenyi, he wasn't called Kenyi, he was somebody who lived in that province. And so he wandered about between Uganda, Sudan, that area without much hesitation because these were the same tribes, the same people.
So speak the similar language.
Speak the same language, similar cultures. Anyway, he came down from up the Nile, actually, because from the Sudan side, he came into what is present-day Uganda. And he was one of those, I would say, nomad. I don't know if you called him a nomad, because people kind of moved around those days quite a bit.
Was it hunter-gatherer?
Yeah.
More or less.
So he comes down into Uganda and finds my great-grandfather from my mother's side now, who was a chief in there. And somehow they bonded. But he was like the gopher, you know? Go get this, go get the other. And he became very popular around the the chief's home because he was the main guy moving around doing things. And this led to many, many other situations in that. It led to petty jealousies. You know how that happens around, you know, a guy comes from elsewhere into the home of another chief. And then because of his diligence and ways, he becomes the main prop for the chief. So they didn't like him because of that. Mm-hmm. And there were many accusations. I don't know whether they were right or wrong, but they were there. And it's interesting because out of those accusations came opportunity. You see?
Mm-hmm.
Out of those accusations, it led to one time when he was actually arrested by somebody you guys will have heard of in history, somebody called Emin Pasha.
Yeah, explorer.
Explorer.
Where is, British, no?
I mean, Pasha is actually, I think he was like kind of Jewish, Turkish, German, whatever. He was also a mixed guy. Yeah.
So
I mean, Pasha happened to be doing running a fort in that area. The fort in the place called Tufle.
Yeah.
That's where we come from now. That's what we consider home now.
Okay.
Because it was a place, called Tufle.
So that's the geographical location.
That place, like this.
Yeah.
The sweat that like sticks to you, you know?
It does. It's hot, right by the River Nile. It's a very hot area.
Okay, so it must be really humid too.
Super humid.
Lots of mosquitoes and I don't even know why people settle there, but anyway.
The river.
Yeah, so anyway, he settles there and when he was accused, he was taken to Emin Pasha. Now, Emin Pasha, as you know, was a taxidermist. He liked to collect samples of flowers and this and, you know, whatever. Keep them and, you know, send them back to Europe as samples of what he found as an explorer in Africa. And there was a leopard around there that was eating up all his sheep and goats. And they couldn't catch it.
Mm.
They really tried. They couldn't catch it. Well, here comes my great-grandfather. Good skills. I don't know where he got them from. But... He then tells the guys, oh, I can get that leopard for you. And they're like, really? He says, yeah, sure. So anyway, he sets a trap. Dug a huge hole. You know, he knows this leopard's a very strong cat. So he dug a hole, got a huge stone and tied a stone to it. Then he got a little kid goat and put it in the hole so that it would attract the leopard. The leopard comes, dives into the hole, grabs this kid goat, and as it tries to pull, it pulls the rope as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the boulder crushes it.
Oh.
So in the morning, the guys come and Emin Pasha is very happy because he's a taxidermist. Yeah?
Yeah.
So now here he has a leopard skin, no arrow holes, no spear holes, perfect specimen.
Yeah. Wow. It was just crushed.
Yeah. So he gets interested in this guy and says, hey, what's the deal, man?
You got some brains.
Yeah. The guy says, well, yeah, that's how to do it. So he says, okay, forget about whatever you're accused about.
Hmm.
You're going back to that village, but now you're the chief.
Mm.
So that now begins our relationship with the Western world and our relationship with that colonial time.
Hmm.
This was 18th century.
Okay.
And so from that time onwards, what happened was that he sent his children to school. That's my grandfather now.
Oh, okay.
And many of his other people. So they now had the influence from they came to school, colonial school then, and they learned English, they learned how to write. So they now became like the go-between, the colonialists and the home people, because they were home people.
I see.
And at the same time, now that they had some education, they were the ones who were used by the colonial system to move ahead. So in that area, that's kind of a general background of where then the rest of us came on, you know.
Uh-huh.
Our fathers also came to school and they learned further. They went further than their fathers. And we went further than our fathers. And now you guys are going further than us.
Oh, yeah. So just progression, right?
Yeah, it's a progression.
Yeah, yeah, I see.
Yeah, but otherwise that area, it's called the Madi District of Uganda.
And
it's changed many, many names now. It's actually called the Moyo District now, after the name Moyo. And yeah, that's where the background is.
Mm.
Now, coming to me personally,
mm-hmm.
I did not really live there because my father was one of those people who had studied. He had gone to Britain in the early 50s. And so when he came back, he was a high-ranking government official, and they kept sending him all over the country.
Mm.
And that's how I grew up, personally. All over the country. All over East Africa, actually, I have to say.
You spent time in Nairobi.
Kampala, Moroto. Actually, I wasn't even born in the tribal area.
Wow.
I was born way out of the tribal area. So, you know, we had 1 year here, 2 years there, another year there. And it was really all over the place. So that's me now.
Okay.
From my father's influence, yeah. Okay.
So the village, the house that we went to, the one I was telling you about in episode one.
Yeah.
That's actually
with the engine in there.
Yeah. Okay. So that's actually
Chevrolet, I think Malibu or something.
It was
Impala.
No.
It's an Impala engine.
Why am I freaking Chevelle.
Yes, that's right.
That's actually like our village home, and that's where you guys would vacation, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, those days there was a lot of kind of mandatory PTO, paid time off, leave, they call it.
Okay.
And so Christmas or Easter or whenever time fell, my dad always took us there to spend a few times with the people at home, my grandmother and many of the other relatives at home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, yeah. What was this? It's definitely, it kind of gives you like a little context to like how I think our family has like moved around. You know,
that's what it sounds like.
Yeah,
you grew up moving all over the region, not one country.
Yeah, so kind of like how we're here right now. You know, it's like we just travel, move around a lot. You know, and I think that comes from like you were saying, Kenya, right?
Yeah, originally.
Yeah, so I mean, man, thanks.
Growing up, life without borders. Growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, it is said that the Kenyi, that's the guy who came from the Sudan those days in Equatorial Province, he basically told us, he gave us his blessings, which was like, go out to the bush and prosper. Now, if you think about it, the bush then was elsewhere because home was that to fill a place.
Mm-hmm.
And all his children basically ended up in the diaspora. Yeah, a good number of his children ended up, you know, whether in the civil service or in the army or in politics, or just stayed at home. In fact, the ones who have moved out, to be honest, are more prosperous than the ones who stayed at home.
Mm.
Why is that?
That's a good question. When you think about it, you know, economics.
Yeah.
I'd that's, say I think, that's the best way to say it.
There's more opportunity.
Economics and opportunity.
Yeah, sure. Opportunity. And most of these people who are learned now, they had studied and their skills were better used elsewhere where there was a bigger population.
Makes sense.
And organization, yeah.
The one thing I would say is that they never forgot where they came from, though. So,
yes.
You know, someone would come home, build a house, and then the extended family stays there or something. But that's one thing I'd say is like, and even when like we were growing up outside of like in Kampala, right?
Mm-hmm.
The family was still very close, you know? We'd go to Christmas dinner and there's like 150 people there, you know, stuff like that, 100 people.
Yeah.
And we still stuck very close together. Right. And we still do to this
very
day.
Very connected. The family was very connected.
Yeah.
And it's remained that way, it sounds like.
It's still. Now with social media, you know, you get to chat with people, you don't even know what they look like.
Yeah.
But you know they're related somehow.
Yeah. The WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
The infamous WhatsApp groups.
Yeah. That's right. That's no, but that's a very good introduction, I think, into who you are and explains kind of, well, what we're about to hear from your insight.
Right.
But for current news, we wanted to touch on the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery.
You want to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean,
I had extra questions, but sure. I have follow-up questions. Wow.
Yeah. I think first and foremost, we need to recognize the tragedy.
Yes.
And you know, blessings to his family and those that were involved, you know. You know, may they find peace. But I wanted to hear the questions that you had, because you said you read a blog that had an interesting answer.
Regarding the shooting, and I guess from our perspective, what it means, because I was reading my older brother Ismail, and he writes like blogs where he shares a lot of time his thought and his views. For him, being spending half of his life in America and moving back home in Africa, you know, started to do his business there and transition to that life. So he wrote a piece about his take on what he felt about the shooting and the significance to him, what it means, especially being someone who has both aspects of the lived in America part and then the black man part too in Africa and beyond. So I just wanted to kind of read a little bit of what he said here. I want to hear both of you guys' opinion on it. Let me open it. Okay, so this was what he shared. He was like, being away from the States is a constant reminder of how we are disconnected from our collective trauma as black people. What slavery and colonialism did was sever nerves that connected humanity of Africans on the continent and African Americans. Religion they can use to unite against another, but never when it comes to the global demand to restore black dignity and humanity. The black race has a collective cry, and we have to wonder why the entire continent is in outrage about a black king being slayed in America. Why the blacks in the U.S. aren't outraged when they see African boys being taken into slavery by Arabs in 2019 to 2020. We used to be one people. We've grown numb to each other's pain. Unless, like me, you swing between two nationalities, Gambian and American, each blow is visceral. And his last paragraph that I like here, he says, similarly, most of my brothers and sisters in the States know very little about the amount of genocides that happened during colonialism in Africa, the human trafficking of African women to Arab countries happening now, the lives being lost at sea or captured into slavery in recent years African boys have faced. They know about Wakanda and Zamunda, though. We have to ask ourselves why. Why is there never a unified voice that vibrates from Alaska to Joburg to demand our humanity to be restored? So it's, you know.
Yeah.
That's a bar.
That's deep, you know. But you see, he's telling you what it is like right now, what the situation is like. In real truth, it's been like this for a very long time. And the important thing is for us Africans to recognize it, first and foremost, and then take up a kind of proactive campaign to restore our own dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to do it for us.
For ourselves, yeah.
The reason why I'm saying this is because when you look at all the other nations, let's call them nations for now. Let's not even talk about color of skin or anything like that. Let's just talk about nations. If you talk about nations and see how they've progressed, they've not treated each other very well too.
No.
But the difference is that because they're looking out for their own interests, they've managed to sideline any other person who is not with them.
Mm-hmm.
And technology has helped them very greatly. And, you know, opportunity. Just go back a little bit in time and think about the Europe, America, Middle East, China, India. When you think about it, in the last 3,000-5,000 years, actually India, China, and the Middle East have had a bigger role in today's society than America even. Because that's where the riches began. 5,000-7,000 year civilizations. And what did they do? If you look down at their societies, they ostracized everybody. In India, they have that caste system.
Caste system, yes.
Where you were, you know, pushed to certain... But this was all about interests, yeah? And then the simpler part of it is the color of your skin. That's the simpler part to look at and say, oh, that guy doesn't look like us, so he should be in the other caste.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier that way, you know, that physically.
It's visual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But what happens is that over generations, what happens then is because that group has been disfranchised for so long, they actually begin to fall back. You see what I'm saying?
You mean in terms of development?
In terms of development, yes. Okay. Because they're always being used as a fodder, let's call it. They're being used.
Yeah.
And over many generations, they actually even begin to accept that factor.
This is what we are.
This is how we are.
Yeah? And this is what's happening, I think, personally, in Africa. We've been used for such a long time.
True.
That we've begun to actually accept that maybe those guys are better than us.
Mm.
And then I think a byproduct of that is us beginning to one, find mediocrity to be okay, right?
Exactly.
And then two, finding ways to cheat the system.
Exactly.
I.e. corruption.
Corruption, you know? Yeah.
So, I mean, you can see, I mean, it's no secret. Like, in majority of African countries, corruption is rampant.
95% right? plus.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
yeah, think about this book by, what's his, sorry to cut it short, but this guy, what's his name, this famous guy who wrote Things Fall Apart.
Chinua Achebe,
yeah, when he said, you know, the Africans have got this saying that if good fortune throws a good morsel into your mouth, why would you spit it out? So,
no, but it's true. And that's a good point that you bring up, because I don't think I even usually reference the historical, you know, reference. I think for me, it's more so I'm looking at it as a limited time span, like, say, the past 100 or 200 years. You know?
Okay.
But the way you've broken down is, like, this has been happening from time. So you could say almost like the people like Alexander the Great and stuff like that, they were people who kind of helped pioneer, like, the Persians and the Indians and whatever to become...
And everybody else, yeah.
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 To kind of start to outpace us. What I would be curious to know is... why is it that we have so much oral history, and why is it that history
was not documented?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we were talking about the Ghanaian symbols and whatnot.
Yeah, the tribal symbols, yeah,
and all that. But it's like, what happened where we just missed out on that bit?
I don't know that we missed out. I don't think we missed out.
Yeah.
What I think happened was there was a deliberate attempt, actually, to keep us down.
Yeah.
Mm. Go back a little bit and think about people like, even now, when there is something going on, like there's a new discovery going on today, yeah? Who is trying to share it with who? Do you see what I'm saying? If it is an advantage, they will try to advantage it.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians tried to make sure their spices kept there.
Yeah, they try to keep in
the Chinese tried to make sure the silks and other things,
gunpowder,
stayed there, you know. Yeah. They didn't want to share them with the Persians or the Europeans, with anybody, you know, because they were getting, that was their means of trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Africa, we were so all over the place. And I would say that maybe sometimes also the fact that the land kind of provided for us abundantly.
Yes.
It was kind of...
So it's like, oh, we have enough.
Yeah, there was really no need to try and be...
To protect those resources.
To protect anything, because it was always there.
Yeah, it's in abundance.
Yeah, you went to the forest, you came back with berries and fruits or animals or something, and, you know, they were always there. So...
And that also translates to the way we are right now. Because when you walk into someone, at least most African homes that I walk into, the first thing is, can I get you something to drink, eat, whatever it may be, right? It's, they're welcoming you into their place. However limited their resources may be, they're treating you as one of their own, right?
And that culture comes from a factor that nature always provided.
It did,
yeah.
While when you look at, so I would say, the other civilizations, let's call them, you have winter coming. If you don't keep stuff for yourself, you're going to starve. You're going to die, yeah?
Yes.
So you get used to the fact that you must keep something for yourself all the time, yeah?
Okay.
Well, in Africa, if you didn't keep it, well, you just took a walk down the road.
And there's something else there.
You came back with something. So when the other guys came down, they had already a different mindset.
Okay. Individualistic.
You know? Individualistic.
That's found, where culture comes from.
Yeah,
they found, collective versus individualistic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean,
they found gold and they wanted it. Well, for us, you wanted gold. Well,
yeah.
You smelted some, and okay, yours is better than mine.
That's why people like Mansa Musa could cause an inflation.
Cause it's like, oh, you guys want gold? You guys like this?
Here, take it, a couple thousand, whatever.
They go back to the rivers and get more.
I mean, I counted. There is 9 mango trees in that village house.
9
mango trees, just mango trees.
Yeah.
Right. So think about someone asking you for a mango, it's like
for one mango, yeah, really, knock yourself out,
you know,
yeah,
like go eat as much as you can.
Just to show you a little thing about that mangoes, actually, I remember your late auntie Anne.
Mm.
She was back home and she saw these kids with, you know, patched uniforms, and and they're walking by, and she's carrying a basket of mangoes on their head, and she's like, let me help these kids and buy these mangoes for them so they can get some money. And so she called them, and they come. She's like, how much are you selling those mangoes? Now, she's been living in the city, so she thinks everybody carrying mangoes on in a basket is going to sell them. And these kids got pissed. They're like, do we look like people who sell mangoes? And then they walked up, and she was shocked because it's like, wait, what just happened here? So these are guys, mangoes? Are you selling mangoes? Really? What kind of person are you?
That's funny.
You can see that variance of thought process.
I see.
Well, if you were doing that, say, in Europe or some other place, you know, you've got something on your head. If you're going to sell it, it's going to be turned into cash value.
Right.
These guys were not thinking about cash value.
No.
It's mangoes. You just pick them in a basket, put on your head, go home. What's the big deal?
Speaking of kind of transitioning into what I wanted to ask you is, business, really. So entrepreneurship. I think in Uganda, it's some really high number of people are entrepreneurs.
Okay. Now, it what might type not be, of entrepreneurs?
That's the thing. It might not be a typical, you know, I have a startup. You get, it's like entrepreneurs in the sense that if I'm in the village, I'll have my own mango or fruit stand, right? And I own that business and I sell the mangoes, or I am a shoe cobbler and I own that.
Okay.
And then you get to the city, it's like, yeah, I own this shop.
It grows in big, it's a large
stuff
scale.
Like that.
Yeah.
It's not like here, you know. Here it's like you come out of school, you look for employment, you know. And although there is that, the corporations are growing back home and stuff, I wanted to get your perspective on like E was saying earlier, people like us who are looking to go back home, right? And what are some of the challenges and advantages that you may have as an entrepreneur? We'll start with challenges.
Let's just look at the historical bit of what happened. If you remember, Uganda was a protectorate. And Kenya was a colony. So what this really did in terms of systems was that the colonists brought in white farmers and white companies and all these guys to come and settle, take the land and create, you know, huge companies and farms and things like that.
Mass agriculture.
And so the deal there was employ these people, employ the Africans to come and work for these multinational companies. They didn't quite get to Uganda, the multinational companies. So since Uganda was a protectorate, it still remained at the peasant, you know, peasant farmer level, where everybody basically went into the garden with his family and dug and produced something, and whatever excess was sold or kept for another season. Now, when you fast forward to the 1960s and 70s, Uganda was fast becoming like Kenya, actually, because the corporations had begun coming in. Then comes Idi Amin. And he chases out all the Indians. And these were the main guys who were trying to...
They operated these industries.
Yes, those industries and so on.
So much like Zimbabwe.
So when he chased them out, there was a huge vacuum now. There was a demand for goods, but there was nobody making them. So Ugandans had to become innovative. You know, they had to now begin to try and see. And the good, and some of them who had been seeing what was happening.
That's a huge challenge, though.
Or, falling into things. They fell and stood up and fell and stood up and started their own challenges. And I think that's about the time when that habit started. Because you didn't see many, when the Indians were in Uganda, you didn't see many African people trying to be traders.
Right.
So it was just like many other places were trying to be doctors and engineers and lawyers and things like that.
So going into employment.
Yeah, that was what school was in everybody's mind, you know. Growing up, we all wanted to be lawyers or doctors or engineers or something like that. So when Idi Amin came, he kind of turned that on its head.
Okay.
We began to see people who had only 2-3 years of formal education becoming millionaires, and were like, wait, what? Where did this start, huh?
Yeah.
And so that kind of changed things. And so some people actually stopped going to school because they thought it was now useless, you know?
Yeah.
They thought, school, what for?
Yeah.
You know? You're a teacher, your pants are torn.
Yeah.
I'm selling beer here, I'm getting a lot of money, and I'm driving a new car. So
Benzo.
Yeah. So So that actually, I think, is got a big part of why Uganda is.
That's interesting. I never knew that.
So it basically kickstarted like being self-sufficient, driven for innovation and business versus.
So by the time it opened up again after Idi Amin left, the Ugandans had already begun to learn some of these tricks and tactics.
Mm.
And they began to see that, hey, wait a minute, this guy is coming to sell us soap.
Mm.
I can make the soap myself, you know? Why do I have to buy it from that guy?
Why, yeah.
So, and also because of habit now, they were used to doing it, and the other guy is entering his market, so he's like, hey, I need to catch up with this.
Exactly. Competition.
So, competition, mm-hmm. yeah. And so I think that's why they rated Uganda to be one of the biggest, what do you call it? What do they call it?
Entrepreneurial countries.
I did see an article.
Number one entrepreneurial
like
country in the world, actually.
Yeah.
But then the West paints, and largely the popular view of Idi Amin's tenure is dictatorship, you know, human crimes and stuff. But people tend to not talk about also maybe the long-term effects of their policies where it could be beneficial for a country.
Yeah.
So what would you say on that?
Well, you see, Idi Amin was trying to do things which were, and it's true, he was kind of a tough, brutal guy, and sometimes you'd say, but he had a good purpose, I think. He wanted to make the Ugandans independent.
Pan-Africans.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think his downfall was?
He was, you know, you're fighting with a bear, huh? The bear being the Western systems, and, you know, he was trying to poke them in all kinds of places. And, you know, that you don't, unless you're well prepared, that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Although, like, I think he...
That's a tough battle.
He had a much better time with it than a lot of our past leaders.
Time with what?
With poking at the West.
Okay.
Because he would come to the Queen and say, you know, I'm sending them... He said he's sending food to the UK because they're starving. And like, what was the other thing?
What a guy.
Yeah, you know, the last king of Scotland and stuff like that. So I think he had a lot better, like more fun doing it than some of our past leaders have.
A lot of wit.
You know, I would say that the difference was that he didn't quite understand their systems as much as, say, people like the late Mugabe.
Okay.
You know, Mugabe was a very educated person.
Oh, yes.
He kind of understood how to play the game. That's why he lasted so long. Yeah.
True.
He studied with like the few other Pan-African.
There's a generation that Nkrumah, Shadow, Dajara, group.
A lot, different from, say, Idi Amin, who was really a basic soldier.
Yeah, he was a soldier.
Followed instructions initially, then got to a point where he realized, hey, wait, I can do this by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't trying to play a game, you know, he was just evolving from what he realized he could do, yeah?
Okay.
Well, the other guys, I think, have been more deliberate, you know, Nyerere, Mugabe, people like Mandela, you know, a little bit more deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of, they realize that you can give and take, you know, it's not the one-way situation.
What's your ideal African leader then?
You know, here's the problem. They all start well. All of them start very well.
Yeah.
I mean, look at a guy like Sankara, for instance. Sankara was huge. He was doing very well.
Mm.
But then he started, just like Idi Amin, stepping on people's toes, and they didn't like it. So they got rid of him.
With him...
That was betrayal, though.
Yeah, that was betrayal.
Yes, but this is the point. You have to understand why the system exists.
You have to play the game.
You have to play that game. And move along with it, you know, while making your people better.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not there, then the game stops.
He makes a point, Ivan, because all the leaders we know like that, who's like, it's my way, you know, and refuse to allow a little bit of tolerance and, you know, allow both sides, they usually got killed or, you know, removed from power.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
And every single one. Every single one.
I would say so. Yeah. Think about it.
And I think also there's a tight rope to be walked, though, because you think of someone like Gaddafi, when Libya in its prime was almost a dream state, I think, for Libyans.
Yeah.
You know, for Libyans.
For all Africans.
Africans. Actually, that Mediterranean, the Mediterranean thing, which you see now, the disaster, you know, boats sinking and so on.
Yeah.
Most of those guys ended up working in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because Libya is not there as a state.
Yeah.
they're going further.
Of course.
Into the Mediterranean, and you know.
But then, I mean, I think you have to ask yourself, how tough is that task to, one, develop the nation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, two, keep the greater good, you know?
Like, you mean discipline, order?
Yes, but then also keep a positive, like, image of yourself. Because Libyans got tired, you know, the Arab Spring whole thing.
Well, that's it.
I think that's such a tight rope to be walked. Where it's
like how they start off good and yeah, it seems to be in order, but yeah, as the years continue, it starts, you know.
I think it's easy. I think it's easy for us to say stuff like, oh, yeah, well, he should have come out of power this time. But it's like, I think in these men's minds, too, they have, it's such a well-oiled machine for them at that point in time that they can't even imagine.
But times change. They don't change with
but
time.
Exactly. But they can't even imagine giving up power to someone else, you know? Much less someone else that might have a different view of theirs. Because that's a very African thing, too. You got to realize, is having the ability to embrace someone else's very polar opposite, you know, view of how you should do things. I think we struggle with that.
Big time.
You know? So, I think there's a very tight rope to be walked in.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any solution to that. Because when you think about it, nearly all, you know, emperors and kings and all these guys, they've all gone through that situation.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why, because I like America being an idea and then evolving into the 4-year kind of democracy thing. Eventually, that's the kind of place you ought to be at, where you can have those regular elections and change things. But think about what, look at America today.
Mm-hmm.
We have a guy in there who would probably be willing to be there for the next 50 years.
How did that work out?
Yeah. And that basically the same kind of feelings and same kind of public sentiment is what put him there.
Mm.
So you got to ask yourself, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm. When? After he got elected, I just know anything is possible in this world.
Land of the free, man.
Yeah.
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 But back to the question though. What obviously you had your time where you were a very I'd say successful entrepreneur in Uganda, and I think dabbled in a lot of things, but
you did, yeah.
what would you say are some of the most blaring challenges you faced and some of the biggest opportunities that you had?
Okay, our biggest problems in Africa, I think, are the structures.
Mm-hmm.
There is no guarantee. You know, like here, you can start a business, and there are certain guidelines, you know, that everybody follows. There's insurance, there's, you know, credit from the bank, there's a certain kind of structured way you can do things. And if you work hard at it and you, you know, punch at your opportunities, you know, you'll make some way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're in Africa, one, insurance is extremely expensive.
Mm.
So there's no way you're going to the banks look at the rates. The banks here are watching the rates.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Looking at 2-4% income, I mean interest.
Mm-hmm.
Out there, I was shocked. You know, it's 30% interest in a year.
Yeah.
Now how much profit are you going to make?
Yeah. Yeah? Much less how are you even going to make payments?
That's already setting you up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, apart from that, the government systems also being corrupt are not really supporting you.
Mm.
If you want support, you've got to go in there and try and, you know, pay your way through, which all eats into the business.
Mm.
So it's a lot harder there, unless you're in cahoots with the government, which means you're also part of the corrupt system.
And I think you were saying that.
And when you're in that system, now you're really not a businessman. You're just somebody who's riding along the coattails of the government in power.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you're going to say, I'm going to do business and I'm going to do it correctly and so on, and there are going to be certain guidelines on how I'm going to do it. Sorry, in Africa, you have to be very, very wily.
Mm.
And I think somehow, because look at it this way, you borrow money, you've got to pay 20% or 30%. By the time that money, whatever you're doing, matures, maybe it's 2-3 years. Now you're looking at 50-60% of the money you borrowed that you must pay back.
Pay back on interest.
it can't work.
How can you even grow?
You can't grow.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times what I think can help us out in Africa is, one, agriculture. Because at least there, there's not a big difference in terms of, you know, if you're wise and you've got some savings or you've got some cheap source of money, you go into agriculture, people will always eat food. It's something that is continuously there. And then you can add value to it and sell it on to... The other thing is housing. We don't have housing, appropriate housing. So real estate.
Real estate.
That's a good area to go into in Africa. What else? Healthcare. You know, pharmacies, hospitals. People need healthcare. Schools as well.
Education.
Education is becoming one of those places. And you see, when you're doing it, something like education, you're not really worrying about inflation. Because you ride along with it. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's the same thing with the food. If the bank is charging 30%, well, next year the food is going to be 30% more or 40% more.
True.
Yeah. Unless there's a glut, which sometimes makes us, you know, like when there's aid from America or somewhere, it messes us up because somebody brings corn. You were producing corn. Now they're giving it out free.
Yeah.
You have a big problem now.
And I think that's another thing too is we don't realize this, but when we, for example, have outside funding, that is not getting, that money is not getting recycled back into our economy. Right?
No, it's not.
It's going back to wherever it came from.
Yeah.
The biggest amount of it actually goes in administration.
Exactly.
I'll give you a physical example I had. I don't remember the exact figures, but remember those Kenyatta sugar works?
Yeah.
Okay, it was a turnkey project supposed to be handed over to Uganda government. And they borrowed money from Arab Development Bank, East African Development Bank, and all. Now, I don't have the exact figures in my mind, but I remember this guy was leading us through what they were doing, and it was like $10 million or so to start the project. And then right off the bat, there was like $5 million, which was off as technical assistance.
$5 million?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was another $2, $3 million for equipment and stuff. And then there was like $500,000, which they said was staff salaries. I remember getting really shocked, you know?
Yeah.
I looked at that thing and I was like, wait, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
Something very wrong.
Yeah.
What is this technical assistance?
Yeah.
I mean, so fortunately, it was not just me.
Yeah.
One of the guys in the Ministry of Finance had also seen this.
Mm.
And so he actually asked, wait, we... Thank you very much for what you're telling us, but what's the $5 million? What's the technical assistance? And this guy was embarrassed.
Imagine.
But he was like, that's the money for the consultants and and technical people.
The technical people.
Yeah, all kind of consultants.
And then this guy was smart. He asked again, how many technical people and consultants do we have? So there was like about 15 guys. Who are technical assistants and consultants, blah, blah, blah. And then they said, okay, and how are the salaries and stuff? How many workers? There was like 1,000 workers.
Yeah.
They're going to be paid $500,000. While these 15 guys were earning the $5 million. But think about it too. When you come to America, you guys come to America, and then you start looking at how much you earn here. It's a huge difference from what you earn in Africa, you know?
Yeah. It is, but I mean...
So you got to realize, but that's been the game all this time.
Yeah.
So the guys who come to give you the assistance take back almost half of what they bring.
I see.
Our salaries and blah, blah, blah. And then the little other bits are what they leave you to continue with. But you still got to pay the loan for everything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I think it's so unfortunate that not many people know this.
No.
You know, things like this.
They don't realize it, yeah.
A lot of the time to hear someone say, there's corruption. Okay, what is that? You know, what does that mean? And people just say, oh, they steal money. But how? You know, people, how?
What's the process?
How I think it's so money? Easy to trick people into embezzlement. And very easy for a lot of these government officials. A quick story. My cousin is an architect and his sister is a road engineer, civil engineer. She said that one way road that the money would get stolen from roads, right, is say the road is supposed to be, I don't know, 30 feet wide, right?
Yeah.
What a lot of these contractors would do is they would make the road like 26 feet wide or 28 feet wide, you know. All that extra material that they have not used, they just go ahead and flip that and make a profit off the road.
Where are the checks and balances for them?
Exactly. So
those are the guys who earn that part of that 2 feet or whatever extra.
The people who are supposed to keep checks and balances. Yeah. You know? So that's quick money, you know.
It is easy, and then
you find that the person who built the road has suddenly the biggest house in the city.
You wonder why.
You know?
Let me tell you, when I was building that house in Namongo, I was looking for gravel. And I went to a quarry. When I get to the quarry, there's some trucks that are ahead of me, so I'm waiting. And then I see one guy, I know him. And hey, we start chatting, and he tells me, okay, what are you doing here? I said, I'm buying gravel. I said, why are you buying gravel? I said, well, I'm building a house. And so he's like, you want gravel? I said, yes, I want gravel. He said, we'll deliver it to you. And I'm thinking, he's going to deliver it to me. I don't have to come here.
Oh, nice.
Good. How much? He gives me a price, which is less than the price I was going to buy at the quarry.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, I don't know how he does it, but maybe he has a good deal.
Yeah.
So I give him the money. I go back. So when I get back to the building, they come back the next day and there's a pile of gravel there. And I'm happy he has delivered. And I'm thinking, I got a good deal, you know? I got a cheaper.
Like, yeah.
But guess what?
What's it?
This guy was the guy who was the engineer. I found this out later.
Oh.
He was the engineer who had been hired to make that road where I was building a house.
Oh my God.
So basically, the gravel that I got was supposed to be tarmac for the road.
That's government funds.
Yes. Now, tell me why I'm not surprised that 2-3 years later that road had potholes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Where did the equipment go? I was part of it. I was part of that system.
So it's a whole system.
I didn't even know.
It's a whole system.
Yeah. But when I found out, I was actually pissed. I was like, you know, I would hit a pothole on that road. I don't know that man.
You're part of the problem.
Man,
this sounds very complex.
Yeah.
If someone wanted to come in, very complex.
Yeah.
Another time I was sitting in Middle East.
Yeah.
And then this guy comes, former schoolmate of mine. We used to drink together. And he sits and he's very happy. And I'm thinking, hey, man, you must have made a deal today. And he looks at me and he says, yeah, I am supposed to be conducting a census in Karamoja.
Which is on the other side of the country.
I'm born in Karamoja, so I was interested in finding out from him. Oh, yeah, so how is it going?
Yeah, are you doing your job?
I haven't gone. And saying, why not? He says, well, that's the money we're drinking. And I'm thinking, wait, what? So in the records, he is doing a census.
Technically.
But he's not.
He's not.
And what is he going to do? He's going to turn up with figures, produce them to the boss, whoever it was. He has had a holiday.
Wow.
The figures are totally wrong. They're cooked figures. But nobody knows because the boss is not interested in going there either. See what I'm saying?
We're complacent people. Yeah, I guess that builds the whole chain of complacency. This is how it is. Yeah. This is how you have to do to survive, you know?
And the biggest problem is because the guy doesn't get a salary that can keep him alive.
Yeah. So that's another thing too, when you go into employment, it's not sustainable for years. I agree with that.
The government salaries, it's like you're forcing people. This is what they're going to have to do if they want to survive and provide for their families. So they won't, you know, there won't be no moral public conflicts with them to do that.
A huge difference from, say, Singapore, where that guy, what was his name again, that general, who decided, okay, I'm going to pay you guys
enough so that you don't have to.
But if you dare do any, if I hear any whiff that somebody bought you dinner or something, you're out, you know? But you can see the difference. Singapore, in the 1960s, was much less developed than
third world.
Today they're ahead.
Yeah.
So I think it's important for us to really look at the personal gratification thing, you know?
Yes.
I know this because I used to take advantage of it myself as a businessman. You know, you look for the cheapest guy and it's the worst thing you can do.
Because you contribute to the problem.
You contribute to the problem, yeah. You contribute to the problem. It becomes, it doesn't do his job or it doesn't do it right or it does it and hits you somewhere else, it'll just come around again. So the worker needs his Bay.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Yeah.
Then Africa has still not got that right.
Yeah.
We're still struggling with that.
And I mean, even for those who are educated, like me and Ibrahim, right? It's, do you go to Uganda and you get paid, you know, half of what you would?
What you and me.
Rather than come out here and,
exactly,
you know.
Exactly.
I mean...
Oh, do you even have the facility to work with? Like, right, look at Ibrahim now. You go right there, you're a Boeing man.
What what are you going to do?
Which aircraft are you going to do?
Yeah. Like, there's no question of that. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And it's a valid question.
Yeah. You know? What am I going to do? You know?
It's true. So,
Yeah.
So,
one of my cousins went and studied nuclear physics, you know, the USSR those days.
Mm.
And he comes back and, you know, he did nuclear stuff. we have no nuclear down there.
Yeah.
Hey.
So he's a businessman now and a politician later. So
you have to adapt or, you know.
Yeah. A lot of unpacking to do there.
Yeah, that's a lot. But it's good food for thought, though, to understand that, you know.
And I think part of solving the problem is understanding the problem.
Yeah, so exactly. That's the first part, right?
First part.
Uh-huh.
So I know we've kind of digressed.
Yeah.
But honestly, that's why I was talking about going upstream.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need to find out, where did we come from? How did this start?
Mm-hmm.
Once we understand that part of it, we can then begin to apply solutions one by one, you know?
I see.
Because it's very important to know that, first of all, like they see the economies what we claim to have today. How did they start?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at Uganda, just Uganda, they used to call it the three C's. It was cotton,
mm-hmm,
coffee,
mm-hmm,
and what was the other one? Copper, I think.
Wasn't it tobacco, though?
No, before that.
And tobacco was in Kenya. Either.
Tobacco also came.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, it was the three C's, because there was that copper mine, in, just one copper mine in Kilembe, and then coffee, cotton. Yeah. And what the British did was they decided, because of the seasonal factors now, cotton will be grown in the north,
mm-hmm,
and then the coffee will be grown in the south. Yeah? And so because of that, people in the north thought they could not grow coffee. Nobody told them they couldn't grow coffee, but because they was not encouraged, and the parents and everybody was growing cotton, they thought, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they did. So many, many years later, people began to realize that, hey, wait, we can also grow coffee. Oh, we can also grow that. Mm-hmm. But the system had been built in such a way that the only outlet for cotton, it was in the north.
Mm-hmm.
Outlets for coffee were in the south. So even if you grew coffee or cotton in any other, where would you sell them to?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now that continued. And then when Idi Amin came and dismantled those systems, the people began to realize, wait, now you can't even grow your cotton. Where are you going to sell it to? Nobody's buying it.
True.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People began to smuggle coffee because the Ugandan system had failed. They were smuggling coffee to Kenya. And because the Kenya system was still intact.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you got to go back. How did it start? Where was the market? Yeah. So if we're going back home, we've also got to ask ourselves those questions. We're going
back. Where is the market?
Yeah.
Where is the market?
Yeah.
And how are you going to sustain it?
Yeah.
Sustainability.
And you've got also got to realize, who are the players in this market?
Mm. As well as factors that change. You know, yes. Population is going to grow.
That's why I'm thinking a south-to-south situation, you know, African to African or whatever it is, will be part of solving that problem, because the markets are there and the logistics of it are quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're going to bring something from China, but then you can make it in Kenya.
Yeah.
You've already cut out that transport leg.
Right.
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay. So how are you going to compete with the product from there in terms of quality and all that kind of thing, and marketing, and you know, you've got to put all those perspectives together and see, where do we start? That's why I'm saying agriculture is the more
My dad tells me that all the time too. Agriculture
is the fastest way you can start,
and people need to eat.
Yeah, and build up from there.
People always need food, and we have a lot of, you know, like coffee. You know, like for example, us in Gambia, cashews, like.
Yeah.
A lot of countries, they can't grow these things.
Expensive too.
Huh?
They're very expensive.
So we don't do, and another thing with the agriculture, I feel like a lot of the problem is we don't do post-processing in Africa.
That's true.
We ship raw materials and post-processing abroad. And that's where the money is, because raw material price versus process price.
Yeah.
Huge difference.
Huge difference. No, I also think a byproduct of what you're talking about, you know, having a cohesive system is it builds intangible things like dependability, you know, or trust, you know, but why wouldn't you want to see your brother succeed, you know,
rather than are you digging into our mentality standpoint?
So that's what I'm saying is by us being
more collaboration, more collaboration.
Yeah, that's a byproduct of it.
And I think those the regional corporations like ECOWAS, East African Community, SADC, South African, they really need to be strengthened. Eh?
Even because things that's like where you find the market. Union,
yeah,
that as a whole needs to be.
It's been weak.
That's the aim.
Yeah.
But it's got to start with those small regional blocks because right now even within the regional blocks, so you're having problems within the little countries, you know.
Mm.
Where the Kenyans will hold on to something and they don't want the Ugandans to bring something to their market. But then China can bring it in. And you know, Those little issues need to be solved.
Yeah.
To open up those markets.
Yeah. This is all like really good.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think anyone who is struggling with where to start when you're going back home is think of questions like this.
Unfortunately, some of these politicians don't even know about these issues.
A lot of it is politics itself where you just get into a position.
Not just that, but think about it. You've been a village school headmaster.
Mm.
Therefore, you're very popular because you've educated all these kids. So when you go to campaign to get the political position, you're going to get the votes. Because if people know you, that's our man. And you're a genuinely good person.
Popularity.
But you do not understand trade. You're the teacher.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You've got to learn trade all over again. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
And then the trader in the village was probably that guy who didn't go to school. And then now he somehow managed to start selling cigarettes on the sidewalk. Now he has a wholesale shop and then he's moved on. He also doesn't understand the real political system. He has worked hard. Yeah. But he doesn't quite know the geopolitics of it.
Mm.
He knows I buy from that factory, I sell here, I've tied it down, I'm making my money. So our politicians need to be people who understand this.
People who are competent enough to understand in their dinner.
And also, sometimes they're not. We need to tell them.
Well, sometimes we tell them and they're like, who are you to tell me?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. And that's a big problem because if you've been a headmaster for 50 years and now you're the member of parliament for the area and this kid whose father you educated even comes and starts telling you.
And naturally, if you're in a position of power, it's naturally like people, you don't want to listen to those beneath you, quote unquote, you know?
Yeah, which is unfortunate, but it needs to happen.
What would you say is your favorite thing about Uganda or Madi or Africans as a whole? What is your favorite thing about us?
I think the social part of it, you know, family lines, family ties.
I agree.
We kind of tend to like our people, you know. Yeah. Somebody called it Ubuntu, brotherhood.
Brotherhood.
Yeah.
That's very heartwarming. And, you know, whether you're broke or not, but you're a brother, you're available and... You know, they're just happy for you.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's very critical.
Yeah.
When you come out of there and then you start living here and the TV is your friend, and that you wake up to those factors.
CNN and Fox News.
Yeah.
Fox News. Though, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, that's a good one. What would you say your other favorite thing is about us outside of the social aspect?
Well, one thing I like is, remember I told you about going back and coming forward?
Yeah.
I actually see progress.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I see progress.
Yeah.
Because like you now, you're an engineer, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many engineers have you got in the family? Or other educated people in the family?
A lot. A lot. Exactly. For a generation.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, what is going to happen? Are your kids going to go backwards?
No, naturally.
They're going forward.
No,
yeah.
I hope not. I'm sending you back.
So they're going forward in terms of progression, skill and progression.
Yeah.
So it may not be this generation. It may be the next generation.
I see.
But it's already a big change.
Yeah.
I look at ourselves today. I mean, I was shocked when we went for Christmas.
Yeah.
It was actually Ayo.
Yeah.
Ayo was telling me that. She was telling me that, you know, you guys have done better than your fathers. And I thought, wait, what?
Yeah.
Because, you know, my dad was a big man in the railways and he was a chairman of the railway corporation, actually.
Big man.
And I never thought about that in terms of position and all that. I was thinking about it. No, I mean, in terms of monetary, I was thinking about it from monetary position.
Mm.
And then I look back and say, wait, I have a house in America.
Mm.
I built houses in Uganda too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My kids have graduated in good universities.
Mm.
American universities. Yeah.
Dream, right?
I'm thinking, wait, this girl, this auntie from the village is actually telling me. To my face that I'm actually progressing, you know, and I'm thinking, it doesn't have to be a rivalry.
Yeah.
But Dad did his bit. He brought us to where we were. We're doing our bit to bring you guys to where you are. Now you guys need to take it up, you know, push
passing
it forward.
The torch,
passing the torch.
And in this process, understanding where you're coming from, it's important for us to communicate to you, like I take, you know, took you guys to the village and showed you what's happening, so that when you want to go back at some point, you've got a history of it.
You've got an understanding
of
where
it's coming.
You're not lost.
You're not lost. Yeah. And you know, it's critical that you don't get lost when you get there, because the people there, they're not sitting down too; they're moving. Yeah.
Definitely.
No one's waiting for you.
So you got to put in your 2 cents, yeah?
No, that's good. That's very good.
I agree.
You
ready, Ivan?
We are ready for... This is a... What do we call in this segment?
Well, trivia? How your age or, you know, how hip...
So, you know the typical stories that I guess your generation
tells us.
We want to debunk some myths.
Like I was always number one in class.
Okay. Undefeated, never lost.
We need to debunk some myths.
Yeah, we're just curious.
Okay.
Do you want to start?
Ivan, you go first.
Okay. My first question is, like, now I've heard many, many stories about how far people walk to school. Like, how far did you guys really walk?
I didn't, I'll be honest with you.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But that's the difference.
Uh-huh.
Because I think my dad had got to a point where he was a district commissioner the time I was born. Yeah. So there were already two cars in the compound and a driver. Yeah. So there was really no need for me to walk to school. I think I did some walking around elementary three, what is B3, B4 there. But that's because the school was like less than a mile away from home.
Oh.
Yeah. And so you just got out of the home, downstream, and you go to home. That was when my dad was either on safari or, you know, safari, like he had gone out of the town or something like that. Otherwise, most times he would pick us up in the morning, drop us off at the school, and then go to work. That's really true.
Yeah.
But I did see many kids walking to school, and many of them walked many miles, I can assure you. That is really true.
Yeah.
They did walk those miles.
Yeah.
I know them. We studied together.
Mm.
And then by the time I got to primary five, then I was in, sorry, this You're thing good. Makes a lot of noise. I was in a boarding school. So I couldn't be walking.
Yeah. Walking to class, basically.
Yeah, walking to class.
Debunked. But no, okay. Well, there are some people that did walk.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But we need to really calculate these on quote unquote 50 mile walks.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, we used to have pressure for report cards and, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's on us. We build this expectation that our parents got all A's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we were so serious. You guys are not serious, you know. So,
yeah.
I guess this needs to be a reality understanding, too, that, you know, we didn't think our parents were just, like, perfect, you know, going to school.
No, the perfect bit, let's skip that. Because we had our share of mischief makers.
We just don't know.
We're starting to learn, I think, at bigger ages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mischief. We had all that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's that age where you kind of become wayward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somehow, the do's and don'ts, you know, socialization process.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, for kids and school has been that you try to use yourself as the tippy, as a good example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that they don't deviate along the way.
But I mean, you consciously know that things do happen as a parent, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, things do happen and will happen to your kid, right? Is that something that you think about?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I'll take it back to my own dad. I think he was somebody who kind of knew about this.
Mm.
he knew that, because he wasn't the top student either. And he kind of knew along the... He never really pressured me for report cards or something like that. I just knew I had to bring them to him, you know? And he'd look at it, and if you were fifth or sixth or tenth in the class, he'd be like, okay, but you can be better next time, you know?
Yeah.
So you'd be challenged to say, okay, now how am I going to bring the same card and say I was number five again?
Yeah.
You know? So you try to be... better when you come back.
Yeah.
And if you came back and you were much better, he was like, yes, now you're keeping your word, you know?
Yeah.
So he was more about that than...
And is that what you instilled onto your kids?
Or I think I tried to. I don't know whether that was... Is that what I did?
Yeah. I'd say so, yeah. I mean, I wasn't ever really like...
You said it. That's true.
All I say is, you know, try and be better next time. But that's what I put. Because if you don't understand something, you really don't understand it. And
yeah.
For somebody to try and beat it down your throat is not fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's better to try and get the person to understand it.
Yes.
Say, hey,
thank you.
Okay, you don't know this, try and learn it, you know? Try and, if you don't get it the first time, second time, try again.
Try again.
Mm. Yeah.
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 What other myth are we debunking today?
Do you have one more myth before the trivia?
Okay, so as a parent, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that you have had to unlearn?
Yes.
About parenting, right? Uh-huh. And things that you maybe someone that was raising you did to you, but what are some things that you learned not to do to your children?
I think that school one is one of them.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Because I do know many parents who tried to be really rough on the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You can tell me whether it was rough on you or not.
We heard about Yvonne getting him in trouble one time with the bicycle.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there were those incidents. Those incidents, yeah.
No, but overall it was smooth sailing.
Yeah,
yeah, you know.
I mean, okay, when did you, because you're still learning as a parent. Or, well, maybe not right now, but when you were raising your children, right, you were still learning to be a parent, right?
That is correct.
How did you, say, use your children to as a learning point versus I know better than you?
You know, it never stops, huh?
Mm.
It never really, really stops. Because like now, I come to you sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey man, can you decipher this document for me? Because I don't know what all these formulas are all about.
Yeah.
I've got to realize that I actually don't know what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
But I know you have studied them
mm-hmm.
and your mind is still fresh about them. So mm-hmm. it's easier to ask you
mm-hmm.
than to, you know, to run around.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were moments for me particularly when it was kind of an evolving process, I would say. You know, an mm-hmm. evolving process. Well, like even simple home chores, let us say.
Mm.
I remember coming home one time and we didn't have a house girl. I think she had been, I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I come home and you guys were there playing around. But the floor was really messed up.
Mm.
Yeah. So I picked up it because I was thinking, these are kids, what do they do? You know, let me just clean up for them. And I pick up this mop and I begin mopping. And you guys were, you were playing, but then you saw me and you were like, hey, we can do this.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it was such an exit, you know, it was an exhilarating moment, I would say, you know, because initially I was like, you know, why am I going to bother my kids? It's my problem that the floor is dirty.
Yeah.
So let me get it clean.
Yeah.
Because their mother is working and, you know, there's nobody here, no house help. But I started it and you guys immediately acknowledged it. Okay, something needs to be done here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are moments when I realized that, wait, these guys are actually not just kids. There is stuff there that is going to be very helpful. Yeah?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so it kind of made a paradigm shift, you know, about the way I looked at you guys now. Because I was no longer thinking about, okay, I've got to do this for them. It was more like, now they can start doing stuff for themselves.
Take action.
Yeah. So now at that point, you're realizing it's a different game now.
Yeah.
You're not trying to hover over the guys. You're now trying to make them kind of come out of whatever shells they've been, you yourself You've has put, been placed on them. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's a good one. I don't know. I don't remember that.
I don't think you'd remember because you were not thinking about it.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
Because
it's like turning point right here.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting. For those parents out there, probably. Very interesting. But yeah,
the other times too when we'd go on a run, you know, I used to take them for a run.
Yeah,
who, this guy?
Yeah. This me.
How
come
long
on,
did he last?
Oh, this guy was the longest runner.
Trust me, I didn't put on weight till like.
And what was interesting was that he would keep going, and the other guys would be like, "Hey, stop! Why is this guy?" You know, so I'd have to slow him down, and as he was going and going and going, man. And I thought, okay. Guy's got some stamina there.
He knows. Those African genes.
East African genes.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, thanks. Yeah, let's get into the trivia.
Okay.
We have some questions for you.
We want to, basically see how...
If you're keeping up with the times.
With our pop culture, our languages, and, you know, talk.
So we'll call this old school versus new school.
Old school versus new school.
Okay.
First one, you can start eating.
So okay, I'll start off with one. I'm just going to say a phrase here, and I want to hear.
See what I know, whether I know it or
not. Yeah,
what you think it means.
What that means.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yo, Ivan. Low-key, I'm big mad.
Low-key, I'm big mad.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Lost?
Lost. I don't know.
What would be your interpretation on that?
Something to do with you've got an advantage somewhere? Does that make sense?
Low-key, I'm big mad.
He's big mad.
I'm big mad.
You're big man.
Mad.
Mad.
Yeah. Like I'm big mad.
Ah, big mad. Yeah. Okay. You're angry about something?
Yeah, okay.
Ah, yes,
okay.
Yeah,
it's good. Know. It's good.
Okay. It's a pass.
Okay.
How about it's lit?
It's lit, that it's really happening. I mean, it's on fire. The thing is okay. Right? Yeah? It's working, yeah? Yeah. Above average, yeah? Okay.
You're the goat.
You're the goat?
Goat, yeah.
Goat as in the animal goat?
What's your best guess on that one?
You're the goat. Is that G-O-T or G-O-A-T?
G-O-A-T.
You're the goat.
All caps.
What the goat? Let me see. What would that mean? Probably like you're the. You go all together, but you're the one that's out of range, somehow.
It's not a bad analogy.
Not bad.
Like
not
you're
bad.
Okay. Maybe low. You're the snitch or something. I don't know.
Not the
snitch. You just
you're on the first time. So the goat is the greatest of all time.
Yeah, it's an acronym.
It's an acronym.
Greatest of all time. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Good.
I didn't know that one.
Yeah.
How about, I don't think you'll know this one, but no cap.
No cap?
Yeah.
No, man, sorry. That's something you guys do too?
No cap.
Yeah. No cap means like I'm not lying. It's like
no cap. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Like no lies, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about Netflix and chill?
Yeah.
Netflix and chill?
Yeah.
It's some kind of guy sitting on the sofa just watching TV.
Yes.
There's more context to that one. Basically, Netflix and chill is, you call a girl over to Netflix and chill is like, you call her over to watch Netflix.
Oh, you guys are going too far.
Yeah. You have other motives, you know?
You have other motives.
Oh, man.
But I guess every generation does its own.
Everyone. What do you guys have? Like the movies?
Yeah.
What would be Netflix and chill like for the previous generation? What would that be?
I don't even know if they have that.
Go to movies. Go to cinema.
I guess go to
cinema. Just like go to cinema.
Yeah, we used to do that because we didn't have the chance to have this
streaming services.
In streaming services during our time, man. By the time the streaming services came, I think you guys were running around as kids already. So
yeah, what's one phrase that you think we wouldn't know?
Yeah,
that
you guys
use
a lot,
use?
Like slang talk, like with your friends. Or, like,
oh man, most of them are nasty though. That's the problem.
Really?
We didn't have a lot of the small talk. We had more of the major items during our our slang was really about happening things.
Okay.
But I think I've, at this point, I've actually forgotten most of
them. Yeah. Fair enough. That makes sense. I mean, it's been so long.
I'm thinking years later, we're going to be saying it's lit.
Yeah, hopefully. But yeah, what else?
We have the Pioneer before, if there's anything else.
Well, the Pioneer of the day today, the
Unsung Hero.
Unsung Hero. That we wanted to celebrate today is Patrice Lumumba, actually.
Mm, great, because I was actually named after him.
Yeah.
That's why I'm Patrick.
Yeah.
Fun fact, guys.
Fun fact, he's named after Patrice Lumumba.
I'm actually named after some of the guys, my father's colleagues who are still alive, they call me Lumumba.
Wow.
So, Patrice Lumumba, tribespeople, he was a Congolese, formerly known as Zaire. Leader, prime minister.
Actually, initially during his time known as Congo.
The Congo, yeah.
It's Mobutu who changed it to Zaire. Then these guys changed it back to the Congo, yeah.
And he was a Pan-Africanist leader, prime minister of Congo.
Fought for their independence.
Yeah. And was he the first prime minister? He was the first prime minister of Congo.
Yeah.
And I mean, what great things can you say he did for Congo?
You know, he was taking Congo on a path that Africa should have adopted a long time ago.
Yeah.
What they called the non-aligned movement.
Yeah.
But there were, just like I said earlier, there were so many interests against him. Nobody wanted to be non-aligned. Think about it. At that time, America, Europe were all fighting socialism. Mm-hmm. And the idea of non-aligned was that you would be in the middle, taking things from the West when you needed them, and if you didn't want them, you went to the East and got them from there.
Mm-hmm.
And this looked like, hey, this guy is taking our cake away.
Mm-hmm.
And we will never get it back if he goes to Russia, for instance. It was like there was that right. Cold War kind of time.
Yes.
So it looked like Lumumba was beginning to align totally with the Russians. The rest of the West could not allow that.
Mm.
Especially during the Cold War time.
Yeah.
So that's really what led to his demise.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mobutu was like, okay, guys, I'll do everything you want. Just make sure I've got the palace in Brussels and my castle in France and whatever. I'll be fine with it. Yeah. Traditionally, Mobutu wasn't the first. There were many other Congolese leaders before who had benefited by raping their people, so he just turned the tables on this guy who realized, hey, he's taking our bread.
Yeah.
But
now to me the most interesting thing is that the CIA even got involved.
Oh yeah.
And they essentially were responsible for his assassination. And
that's what people say. And I think
there were CIA agents freely talking about it. You know.
Yeah.
But we want to celebrate his legacy and his life. And
he's unsung, you know.
Yeah, he's unsung.
People, we don't hear about him in the history books as we should. Yeah,
and, you know, many people might not know about him, but if you get the opportunity to... He started out as an instructor, right? He was a teacher, I think.
It was actually a sales... No, you wait, what
did he do? He sold beer.
He was a salesman at some time, he also worked with the post office at some point.
Yeah, but he was very well-educated, nonetheless, right?
Well... For the time, yeah.
For the time, yeah.
For that time, yeah.
But he...
Fought for his country, you know?
Yeah.
Loved his country and, you know, embraced Africanization of governments.
So that's our unsung hero for today. Patrice
Lumumba. And he has a movie called Lumumba.
There is a movie. Mm-hmm. There's documentaries.
Documentaries.
Yeah. Lots of documentaries on him. And
he was one of the first, you know? Him and Kwame Nkrumah and... A few other people. And I think at that time, honestly, nobody quite knew where Africa was going. What had happened was they had just climbed in. They sort of flipped. They came and climbed into the colonist shoes. And then when they discovered that the colonists had other agendas, you know, they tried to shift.
Mm.
That was a dangerous thing for them.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that was the first phase, you know. The second phase came when there were all these military coups in Nigeria, in Ghana,
in the 60s and 70s, you know,
then
back up to Idi Amin.
Yeah. Uganda had that was the 6 years of unrest.
That was the second wave of leaders also being shaken because they were trying to realize what the West was all about and what they wanted for their countries. Then again, they were shaken out when people realized these military guys only know how to oppress their people. You know?
Dictatorship.
Then again, because it wasn't helping the West interests either, mm-hmm. so they had to be shaken out of there again. Mm-hmm. So now you have another crop of what they call the new leaders. Mm-hmm. Museveni's being some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have not turned out so good.
Mm-hmm.
Like this guy in Eritrea, he's another story, you know?
Yeah.
And so... Yep. Now nobody, so, and I think they also realized that, wait, you can't keep shaking this, because when you shake out the leader at that point is really the system.
Yeah, true.
So you have to start building from scratch once the leader is gone.
Yeah.
It's not like in the West where, you know, one guy goes, the system is...
System's already in place.
In Africa, we're still kind of lacking.
The leader goes with the system.
The leader goes with the system. You have to start from scratch again. And so the West must have woken up to that, especially... very much lately after Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and all these guys, they're realizing that wait.
Take examples.
Yeah.
If you shake out the guy, the systems are not built around...
The whole, it's the head of the snake thing, you know?
Everything goes.
Everything falls too.
So including your own interests.
Yes, true.
So they have to realize that, hey man, you know, take it easy with these guys, you know?
Allow that.
Yeah, otherwise you all lose.
Yes.
Everybody loses.
Everybody, true.
Yeah. So it's just unfortunate, but that's, you know, that history has been full of that kind of situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, we can go on for days.
Yes, this will be good. This is the Bantaba version. You
exactly.
Know? We need some attire, some tea.
But no, thanks, Pops, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you guys. I mean, I know I kind of sometimes digressed.
No, you worry. That's what we're all about.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of gems to be picked up for our listeners, you know, for those who may be a little bit lost as where to start, you know, looking for their history or researching who they are. But I think you've provided a very good, like, basis for them to... And I mean, not just basis. There's been a lot of depths to some, you know, issues that we have around us.
Yeah.
So thanks for popping on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All I can say is I wish somewhere along the way, you know, like this guy of ancestry.
Yeah.
I think we should go back and trace many of our ancestors.
Yeah.
And be honest about it, you know, see where they're coming from, see what changed them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And learn from some of those examples. Because we'll find that although we think Africa is kind of the dark place, that's really what the press tells us.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, it is not,
no.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it is the narrative here which is important because it kind of discourages people. When in reality, it is moving forward.
Exactly.
It really is.
Yeah.
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 We're progressing.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks for making the drive. And until next episode, this has been episode 4.
Yes.
It's late. All right, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.